Magic Lessons is supported in part by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. They offer an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price with a kind of incredible risk-free trial and return policy. Get this, you actually get to sleep on the mattress for like 100 days, for exactly 100 days. And if you don't like it, you can return it after that. With free delivery anywhere in the U.S. and Canada and painless returns. And, you know, that's what you want in a mattress is painlessness. All the mattresses are made in America and the pricing starts at $500 for a twin size mattress and $950 for a king size mattress, which is pretty extraordinary compared to industry averages. So here is the special offer to listeners of Magic Lessons. Magic Lessons listeners can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/lessons and using the promo code LESSONS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Just a heads up, everybody. These are adults having adult conversations, so there is the possibility of adult language. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Magic Lessons, a podcast produced by MaximumFun.org. I'm Elizabeth Gilbert, and last year I wrote this book called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. But even when I was finished with the book, I was definitely not finished with the topic because I'm still as much as ever fascinated with the intricacies of the creative process and how we find our way through that strange journey, the obstacles we meet along the way, and the joy of what we ultimately create. And it is through my desire to keep having that conversation that this, the Magic Lessons podcast, was born. So here we are, season two, and we are back. Back with more real conversations with real people, amateurs and experts. This season, we will be meeting poets and novelists, dancers, photographers, comedians. And whether they're ready or not, me and my friends are going to help them figure out how to shake off their fear, get unstuck, and start making stuff. You know why? Because I think they are ready. So let's go. Today, I'm talking to Cecilia in Florida.
Hello.
Hi, is that Cecilia?
This is.
Cecilia, it's Liz.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really looking forward to talking to you. Thanks for picking up the phone.
Of course. I've been looking forward to it for a while.
Well, good. So listen, your essay that you wrote for your application to be on this podcast,
yes,
kind of made my heart break in a thousand pieces. It's really intimate and it's very vulnerable, but I'm wondering if you would mind sharing it with everybody so that we can all start at the same emotional point. Would that be all right? Do you mind doing that?
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely do that.
Okay, go for it, sweetie.
Okay. I am a poet, or I try to convince myself that I am. I have a perpetual and desperate fervor for art of every form, but poetry is the way it spills out of me. I poured everything into applying for MFA programs, but I didn't get accepted where I applied. This was soul-shattering. I stopped writing completely. Since I've pieced myself back together, I write again, but I cannot find the purpose or passion project that writes this handicapping event. Many incredible and successful poets deemed my talents insufficient. And after that, how can I continue to call myself a poet?
Oh, honey. Thank you for being so honest and candid. And we have so much to talk about around this.
Yeah.
But the first thing before we even get into it is I just want to say I'm really, really sorry that happened to you because it sounds horrible. And I think I know because I think my producer told me, but can you tell me how many MFA programs you applied to?
Yes. It was a couple of years ago. I think it was about 10 or 12, I think.
Yeah. Good Lord. That must have sucked. That's so awful. Like, so painful. I mean, you did the thing, the brave thing, the big and bold thing, and you didn't get what you wanted out of it in a really big way that looks sounds like it had very hurtful vibratory repercussions upon your life.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. So tell me about your background in poetry. Tell me what poetry has meant to you in the past, and then let's talk about what this did to you, and then let's talk about moving forward.
I always loved art and writing. I kind of loved storytelling in that I loved telling stories. I also loved taking in stories, and that was true from, I don't know, as long as I can remember. But it wasn't until college when I actually kind of focused that into poetry. And I think I did that because just as much as I loved the storytelling part of writing, I really loved words and how words sounded and what words meant. And for me, poetry was the way that that kind of manifested itself. I really was drawn to poetry, and it just kind of felt like it was right and like it connected with me. You know, then 4 years of everything being about poetry for me. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to fault any of the poetry professors I had, because I loved them, and many of them I still keep in touch with. But I do think I was really shown that the best way to continue with poetry was an MFA program. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of the only pathway I saw.
Right.
And maybe they didn't tell me that was the only way, and maybe it's just the only thing I took in. Right. But it definitely was, in my mind, the path to continuing to be a poet.
Right. And then?
And then?
Let's go back and revisit those dark, dark weeks. Let's go right to the bottom of this thing. And then we'll just claw our way out of it. You can do it. You can do it. What did it feel like when all of that rejection came at you? And I'm asking you because you already have lived the worst nightmare of every mm-hmm. aspiring artist that I know. This is why people don't put their work out in the world, right? Because of exactly this fear, of exactly this outcome, that you will jump and the net will not catch you. And neither will the second net or the third one or the fourth, all the way up to the 12th. And where did that leave you after you had fallen through the air and found yourself repeatedly not being caught by what you felt like you really needed and wanted?
I felt so disconnected from who I thought I was. I had this purpose driving me for so long before that, and I felt really untethered and lost when I didn't have it anymore. I felt like not only was I told that I wasn't good enough, but I also had convinced myself that I was. And at that point, I realized maybe I wasn't an adequate judge of my own art. Right. And I felt really separated from like the identity I put on myself as a poet and as an artist.
Right.
Like I said in my essay, I stopped writing. I just couldn't do it. Before that, I kind of had this mindset that I would sit down and write every single day. I had a journal. I at least wrote one poem a day. Even if it wasn't anything worth going back to or editing, I sat down and I wrote every single day. After that, I didn't do that. It took me a very long time to be able to sit down with myself as a writer again.
I can understand that. I don't want to gloss over the pain of this. You know, because anything that made somebody who couldn't stop writing suddenly not even be able to start writing is a truly traumatizing blow, you know? And I think we have to honor how hurt you were and how dazed you must have felt, you know? And also what a violation it is of what our culture kind of teaches us, which is jump mm-hmm. and the net will catch you, right? Fortune favors the bold, you know, all of those adages and bumper stickers about, you know, what would you do if you knew you could not fail? I mean, all of this is what we're fed, this story that says, if you put yourself out there, you'll get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be a really bracing dark baptism to be dipped into the waters of reality around that, you know, and especially in the arts. I wrote about this in Big Magic, but I said that, you know, in other fields, in other realms of the world, the American kind of, you know, be disciplined, put yourself out there, work hard, and you'll be rewarded and successful. You can kind of count on it, you know, in a lot of other fields. But in the arts, it's not necessarily the algorithm that's going to work because it's so deeply subjective. And mm-hmm. there are so few people who get crowned. And there are so many people aspiring for the same few positions and for the same few publications. And obviously, it didn't kill your creative spirit for two reasons. One is that you have started working again. So mm-hmm. some green shoot of life came up out of that desert landscape, right? And the other reason is you wrote me this essay, you know,
mm-hmm.
which was sort of throwing a rope out into the darkness saying like, hey, is anybody out there? I'm like, yes, I'm out here. I'm out here. I got your rope. I hear your story. And the other reason I wanted to talk to you is because I want to talk about this whole thing about who gets to decide and determine whether you are legitimate as an artist or not. And
right.
I feel like we need a new perspective on this. And so I have a little quiz for you. Don't worry. It's no pressure. I'm hoping it'll actually make you feel better. But this is about some of my feelings about MFA programs. And by the way, full disclosure, I do not have an MFA. And as you can see, I've done fine, right? So let's just say right at the top that this is not necessary. And this is not to say that that was not a real blow. It is just to say that this is not the only path to becoming a creator. And to put it in full perspective, okay, ready? I have a little quiz, pop quiz for you. Yeah. How old is poetry? Take a guess.
I don't even know if I could put a date on that. I don't know.
Well, we can't. Because we don't know. We only know that poetry predates literacy in human history. Poetry is so old that it was around before there was such a thing as written language. So before we even had the technology to write poetry, for untold thousands of years prior to that, human beings were singing and speaking and creating poetry. But if we're going to be didactic about it, the earliest written poem that we have evidenced is a poem written on papyrus that comes out of Egypt that was written in 2500 BC. So that's 4,500 years ago. And it's called The Tale of the Shipwrecked Sailor, which seems remarkably contemporary. It's sort of like, seems like a 19th century like English work. But no, it's an epic poem, so old that it makes the Iliad look contemporary, right? So just to be really conservative in our estimate, let's just use the word 5,000 years. Like poetry, as we know it, is essentially around 5,000 years old, written poetry. So let's put that into perspective. How old are MFA programs? Do you know that answer?
I don't know. I would guess 100 years old.
They are 80 years old. The first MFA program that ever occurred was at the University of Iowa in 1936. And suddenly we've decided that this is what it means to be a poet, right? Mm-hmm. So you see what I'm getting at here?
I do.
And this is, and let me just say, I have many friends who attended MFA programs. I have many friends who've taught in MFA programs. I spent a semester teaching in an MFA program at the University of Tennessee. This is not a disparagement of this entire movement. It's just to say that I beg you to put this thing into perspective. You know, when you said, after that, how can I continue to call myself a poet? Because you were not accepted into an MFA program for poetry. And we look back at 5,000 years of human history of being poetic, writing poems, and creating this work. All of a sudden, this just doesn't seem like a good enough measure to me. It just doesn't, you know?
Right.
And I hope you feel that sort of deep in your marrow, that that cannot be the measure of whether you get to be a poet.
Yes, it makes me feel much more connected to poetry than, you know, this small amount of time that I've been working on it really shows.
What I want you to know about you is that you've been invited into a brotherhood and sisterhood that is an ancient sect, and you answered that invitation of your own volition because you felt that calling. I mean, that's what vocation means. Vocation is a word that means calling. And you responded to it with honor and with love and with passion. And that invitation has not been rescinded because the people or spirits or life force or creative urge or muse or whatever we want to call it that offered you that invitation several years ago doesn't give a fuck about whether or not you have an MFA. I'm just saying that in the most adult language that I can possibly offer. And here's how we know this is true, because I know intimately these people, and you in your life will meet them as well. People who did get accepted into those programs and did get the opportunity to spend a few very bucolic and pastoral years studying with great masters and came out of those programs and never wrote again.
Right.
Because once they were out of that structure of the professors and the school and the deadlines and the community, they didn't really know what to do, you know? And once they didn't immediately get either a teaching position or a job or a book deal, they didn't know what to do anymore. And they stopped. And that invitation was never answered again. So these degrees can no more guarantee your ability of being a poet than if you were to go down to CVS and buy a certificate that says that you're a poet. What is going to make you a poet is whether or not you do this work and whether or not you continue to honor this vocation. And this brings me to the next thing that I want to talk to you about, which is the difference between the words career and vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Long before I had a career as a writer, and when I say long before, I mean a decade before, writing was my vocation. And during that entire period of time, I wrote every day and I sent my work out to publications. And I have 7 years of rejection letters to show for mm-hmm. how much the world was not interested in what I was doing at that time. And the reason that I didn't stop writing was because the career was secondary to the vocation. And believe me, I think it's wonderful to want a career, and I still want one. And I'm happy to have one. But I'm not in charge of that piece of it. The only piece I'm in charge of is what I'm creating and producing. And the wonderful, galvanizing, empowering, illuminating gift of having a vocation, which I do believe you have, is that nobody can take it from you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that holy invitation that was offered to you and was offered to me is sacred to me. It's a holy vow. And then if you can make something out of it where you get to live off it, great. Great. You may be able to do that. You may not. You may be able to do that for a few seasons of your life and then not. But if the vocation remains lit up, then the rest of it becomes secondary. And the rest of your life becomes about creating circumstances in which you can support that vocation. And if that means having a day job or 5 day jobs, then that's all right, you know? And when I spent that one semester teaching in an MFA program, which I wanted to do in order to be more fair about the way I talk about it, I really wanted to know what it's like in there. So, and I went in there and I loved my students and I loved the faculty, and some of their work was extraordinary, the work of these students. But all I wanted was for them to not be in that classroom, Cecilia. All I wanted was for them to be in the world, you know? Mm-hmm. I just wanted to like open up the door every day and be like, guys, just go out there. What you're looking for is not in here. You know, you don't need my permission to do this, and you don't need my certification to do this. The inspiration that you're seeking is out there. I want you to be out there rolling around in it. I want you to be getting dirty and smelly with it. I want you to be brushing up against it and making love to it and being in the world the way Walt Whitman was in the world. You know, under these fluorescent lights with these 12 people sitting in desks in a semicircle and everybody has their drink from Dunkin' Donuts, I don't think this is where it's happening. You know, and that's not to say that mm-hmm. wonderful things didn't occur in that workshop setting and that I didn't love the work that came out of it, but I just wanted to hold them upside down by their ankles and shake them loose of this idea that this is where they were going to learn how to be writers. You know, I want to do that for you too. I want to liberate you from that requirement.
Yes.
And I also would like to Pollyannishly throw in this possibility, which is that you may have been spared taking on a great deal of debt.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? I mean, had you been accepted into any of these MFA programs, if they had given you a free ride, that would have been great. But if you had not been given a free ride, I know you would have scrambled like hell to raise or borrow, probably at very steep cost, the money to go to these programs. And I'm really glad you didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really glad you didn't do that, because the last thing that an artist needs is debt. And it's a real impediment in the world, right? You can be poor. You can be broke.
Yeah, I'm fine being poor.
But to be in debt means that you're living under a tremendous burden.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the biggest issues that I have with this whole system is the way that it takes the people who least should be in debt, you know, creative, sensitive people, and puts them into debt while telling them that we're offering you a service.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, the average MFA program costs $30,000 total. And the average first payment for a first book is somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. And that's if you're lucky enough to ever get a book deal. So, you know, mm-hmm. this isn't like going to medical school and then you're going to get a job at the Poetry Factory, right? Like, this isn't how it works. And so I just offer this not just to you as a balm for your great loss, but to mm-hmm. everybody out there who feels like unless they have this certification, they are not legitimate creators. Tell me if what I'm saying sounds accurate or like bullshit.
It is really lovely to hear, actually. I mean, it's incredibly empowering, but it feels, hearing you say it makes, it takes some of the gravity off of it. And it makes the fact that I do continue to work and I do now continue to push forward despite this, feel so much more important for me. And honestly, I don't ultimately need it to be important for anyone else. I just want to find a way to keep making things for the rest of my life.
That's totally on the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just possible. It's happening already.
Yes.
And it's also, there's a wonderful liberation. My friend, Pastor Rob Bell, talks about this. Like when the most humiliating and shameful thing has already happened to you.
Yeah.
And it's like a firing squad happened and then you walked away from it and you're like, oh, wait, the worst thing I could imagine has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still standing. That's kind of incredible. Like that means, well, what does that mean? If the worst thing already happened to you and you're still surviving, what does that mean?
To me, it makes me feel like I can still keep that identity that I had before as an artist.
Hell yeah. Not only that, it's got bloodstains on it now, so it's for real. You know, it's 100% for real. Like, it's got Medal of Honor on it now,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you went right to the front lines and you got wounded and you're still there. So I have three assignments for you.
Mm-hmm.
The first assignment is I'm going to give you a choice. The Iliad, the Odyssey, the Vedas, or Gilgamesh. These are the oldest sort of popular poems that are still around. I want you to pick one of those and read it.
Okay.
And read it, because I want you to tune back into this idea that you're a participant in something that's very ancient.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to choose a line from one of those epics that is going to be yours. So look in there for a sign that's a voice across the ages from thousands of years ago to Cecilia right now, welcoming you into the fold of being a poet. So find a line in there. Next time I call you, I want you to tell me what it was.
Okay.
And that's going to be your sort of poetic connection to this much, much, much more ancient idea of what it means to make art. And the other thing I want you to do is I want you to write a diploma for yourself. You need a certification, you get to write it. Because the ultimate authority for who gets to be in charge of whether or not you are a poet is and only can be and only ever will be you. And if you put that authority into anybody else's hands, that's a recipe for suffering. This doesn't mean that you can't in the future try to put yourself out there again in different mm-hmm. ways, whether it's trying to get published or who knows, trying to apply for an MFA program again if you feel someday that that's what you want to do. Not what you need to do, but what you want to do.
Right.
But in the meantime, I need you to reinstate your own authority. So I'm going to have you draw up a diploma. And I think you're an artist more than just a poet, right? Like, are you? Did I
yes,
get right that you're a visual artist? So I'm
uh-huh.
going to need to see a photograph of this.
Okay.
You're going to need to create this in whatever form you need to make it. It should be very beautiful because it's going to hang on your wall. It's your certification.
Mm-hmm.
It's your diploma. Because if anything in the arts is your career, you may spend the rest of your life arguing with the world about whether they accept you as an artist. But in the mm-hmm. meantime, this thing that you have in your mind about whether or not you're allowed to lay claim to this identity, we're going to have you be instantly certified. And there's another thing I'm going to ask you to do, which is a not doing.
Mm-hmm.
For the next year, I don't want you trying to put your work out into the world. And I know this is contradictory to everything that I'm always telling everybody to do, that I'm always telling them to put it out there and to show it and to let people see it. But in an official, professional, career-based, striving way, I don't want you doing that right now. I just want you to fall in love again with your craft, with no disappointment possible, because you're not even going to try right now to get the world to accept you as anything. You're just going to reconnect with this thing. And then when that year is up, you're allowed to bring it out into the world again once you've seen what you've made. Does that seem like a reasonable bargain to you?
It does. I'm really excited about it.
Does it make you feel a little more relaxed?
Yeah, it does. It takes like a huge pressure off my chest.
Yeah, because I think we really need to unthread in your life and in many people's lives this difference between career and vocation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a year for you to reinvest your energies and your time and your love in this work that brings you to life. And you can take care of yourself financially other ways throughout this year, right? There's mm-hmm. a lot of ways to make enough money to live. And you don't have to do it by selling your art. Right now, I want you to become your own patron, the person who supports the artist who is connected to a thousands of years old tradition that only recently has become deeply and oppressively professionalized. So how's that sound?
It sounds wonderful.
I'm wondering if you can share with us what other things you do to support yourself in the worldly world.
I do two different things. So my main job is that I work as a marketing copy editor for a law firm. And then additionally, I do a lot of contract work, editing and writing children's books for educational publications. So I recently was writing some children's books for the country of Jamaica. So I worked with a college and some professors who are trying to create math stories for children in Jamaica.
That is such a cool day job.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
I love it. That is so deeply specific and very interesting. Mm-hmm. If I had had to guess, we could have sat here for a long time with me guessing what your day job is, and writing children's books about math for school children in Jamaica would have not come up in the top 10 list that I could have imagined. Well, you know, keep doing that, you know, because look, you have a body that lives in a real and material world and needs to be supported and taken care of. And that's just a reality of part of the contract of being human.
Right.
And that is, however, not all that you are. You are also a deeply sensitive, emotional, and artistic soul who is being called to do something else with your time as well. You know, and there's no reason whatsoever that those two things cannot coincide and coexist. But that sacred flame of vocation must be kept lit. You got it?
I do, yes.
If it's all right with you, I'm going to be checking in with you later in the summer. Does that sound good?
Of course.
And I also want to talk about your case with a friend of mine who I think will have some really beautiful and helpful things to say about it. This is the poet Mark Nepo. Are you familiar with his work?
I'm not.
He's wonderful, beautiful poet who has a great deal to say about rejection and loss and very soulful and very wise. And I think that he will be able to add great depth to this conversation. So I'm going to bring him in to talk to you, and then you'll have some extra guidance along the next and new and bright chapter of your life where you do not have any MFA debts to pay back.
It sounds wonderful when you put it like that.
I know. listen, I'm proud of you for not folding completely. And it's evidence that, you know, as the great essayist and writer Clive James says, failure serves a purpose. It asks us if we want to go on making things. And this failure definitely has asked you that. And it sounds like mm-hmm. the answer is yes. So I'm not worried about you. You're going to be all right.
It means a lot to hear you say that.
You got this, Cecilia. I will catch up with you and go make your diploma and go read an ancient epic poem.
Okay.
Find your guiding muse voice and get back to work.
I will do that.
All right. Bye, sweetheart.
Bye.
We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, I'll be talking with Mark Nepo about Cecilia's case. But first, a word from our sponsors. How great would it be if the post office was open 24 hours? What if it actually was, but like in your house, from your desk, from your laptop, on your printer? That's what you get when you sign up for Stamps.com. You can print postage whenever you need it, right from your desk. No worries, no struggle, and no annoyances to your daily life. You can get all your mailing and shipping done on your schedule. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and you can use my promo code, LESSONS, for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. And before you do anything else on that website, what you're going to do is click on the microphone that's at the top of the page and type in this magic word. And that word is LESSONS. That's stamps.com. Enter lessons.
Going into a Bullseye interview, I know that it's somebody who does amazing work. But I don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about that.
Is that possible?
That's
true?
Possible. Yeah.
Should I check with your therapist?
No, but I will be.
Who are you, dude? You all over the place. I got a lot of respect for you, man. That's dope.
Bullseye. Creators you know. Creators you need to know. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, we're back. Before the break, we heard from Cecilia, the poet in Florida. And now it's time to talk about her case with my friend, the wonderful poet and author, Mark Nepo.
Hello.
Is that Mark?
Yes.
It's Liz. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well. It's wonderful to hear your voice. Thank you so much for doing this with us today.
Well, you're welcome, for sure.
It's an honor to have you on here. I want to enlist you to help me help somebody. And I know that you're such a compassionate soul, so I'm hoping that you'll be able to offer some wisdom and guidance to a young woman who I'm coaching on this podcast. Can I tell you about her?
Sure.
So her name is Cecilia. She's a young poet in her mid-20s, and poetry is something that is sort of a life force, oxygen source for her. And she's been, I don't even want to say the word disciplined because it implies a kind of, you know, rigor. She's been joyfully writing poetry for years and years. And she finished college and then applied to about 10, possibly 12 MFA programs, all of which rejected her. And she was so devastated by this string of rejections that she lost the ability to work for a while and to write and fell into great despair and is now sort of coming back to life after that. But took a big blow, you know, at a tender age when such blows are not very, you know, it's hard to be resilient at that age. And so I've been sort of guiding her and trying to give her my advice and my thoughts about perspectives on the big question that she has, which is how can I continue to call myself a poet when the poets who guide these programs deemed her talents insufficient. I've already spoken with her, but I was wondering if just given even that little bit of background, you might start to lob some thoughts out there and we can see what you've got to say about it.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, this is something that I think is part of the archetypal journey. Most of us in discovering who we are, whatever our gifts, come to a passage and a crossroads, whether it's one or a parent or 10 MFA schools or whatever it might be, where we have to discover the authority of our own being. And it's a difficult passage, but it's a foundational one. For me, you know, back when I was trying to go to graduate school for writing, back then, the school that was I so wanted to go to was Columbia University, and it had some poets that I was just so respected, and I didn't get in. I didn't get accepted, and I was devastated. And, you know, I was kind of forced and feeling, I'm sure, what she is feeling. I think we all feel like, oh, am I really here? Am I really heard? Am I really seen? And what I was reduced to was there was this direct connection to the universe. And, you know, even though it was painful not to be heard, I couldn't stop hearing. Even though it was painful not to be seen, I couldn't stop seeing that. You know, my lifeline, even I learned ultimately whether I wrote anything down or not, my lifeline, my conversation with life force and the universe depended on my direct experience and the authority of my own being, which means not that I'm self-contained, but that I then connect to the well of all spirit, that through the bottom of my authentic experience, I connect to the well of all spirit. And I look back and, you know, while that was so hard not to go to be able to study with these people that I respected, I actually look back and I know now, I wasn't ready.
Right.
I was so impressionable that I think if I had gotten what I wanted, I wouldn't have found my own voice. I would have become an echo of these people I respected, not necessarily because they were going to shape me into that, but because I didn't know myself enough to learn from them without becoming them.
Right, right. Not to mention the other students in the class who also would have been young poets searching for their own voices.
Yeah.
And
so I think
a bit of an echo chamber, perhaps, even in there.
Yeah. And so I think that it might be as painful as this is to keep pursuing your own direct connection with the universe, and the trail of that conversation becomes a sacred teacher.
Right.
You know, that's the other thing, is that I feel that there's a big difference between giving attention and getting attention.
Can you explain that? Yeah, because you've said that to me before, and that's something that's always struck in my mind, is we live in a society where everyone's trying to get attention, and you've spoken about, well, that's all very nice, but what are you giving your attention to? Please elaborate on that for us, because I think it's really important.
Sure. You know, we're taught at an early age that to get ahead, you need to get attention. And in the world of circumstance, some of that is, of course, necessary. But that's not why we do any of this. We are recognized and verified by giving our attention. When I was a boy and I didn't even know what poetry was, I didn't know what spirit was, it was giving attention that allowed me to trip into wonder and beauty and into hard truth. And, you know, stumbling, for instance, into my godfather's bedroom when he was dying of cancer, and seeing and giving attention to him, and I'm just a little boy, I don't know what's going on, but there was something in the truth of that that fueled my soul by recognizing and verifying life where we find it, truth and beauty and wonder and surprise, that we keep growing. And when we get attention and keep, you know, trying to get attention, and that goes out of balance, we cut off our own oxygen supply inwardly. So it's interesting that, you know, if you're a little girl and someone sees you singing on the playground and you have a nice voice, sooner or later someone says, you should become a singer.
Uh-huh.
And if I express myself, someone says, you should become a writer. And if you like to have your plant things or put your hands in the earth, then someone says you should become a gardener. And there's nothing wrong with those things, but notice that we're being told to become a noun.
Uh-huh.
And the vitality of life is in staying a verb.
I love it. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. I just wrote down what you said, Mark. I know that it will be documented on the podcast, but I find whenever I'm around you, even in polite conversation, I'm like, hang on, I got to get a napkin.
No,
I got to write down what Mark just said. That's wonderful. And I also was hearing that people are telling you to become something you're already doing, right?
So
it's a little bit redundant. Like somebody's singing well, you should become a singer. Well, it looks like it's happened or happening already. It's already occurring.
You know, I would encourage this young poet to keep doing what brings her alive. And even with publication, schools, all of that, it really all feels like the best we can do is like casting seeds. And then you just don't know which are going to sprout.
Right.
Which will have rain come on them, which will have sun come on them, warmth. But then to get back to work. Just get back to work. And what is the work? The work is staying in conversation with the sanctity of life, wherever it might show itself.
I was going to ask you how you differentiate, or if you differentiate, what it means to do that as a poet and what it means to do that just as a human being or as a different kind of artist. What is the place that a poet inhabits in that landscape that is particular?
Well, I think that as I've gotten older and everything, I think they're pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think immersion, to be so present that there's, for the moment, nothing between us and life. And I learned this from my father, who's now gone, who was a master woodworker. But, you know, I watched him when I was a little boy. He would make these incredibly detailed two-scale models of sailing ships from the 1800s. And, you know, we were all taught that to put in effort might yield excellence. But I discovered by watching him, because I could tell he was not only immersed, but he had such joy in being immersed completely, that it felt to me like when he was that devoted, he was in the moment of everyone who ever built a boat.
Mm.
And that is the reward for immersion, is oneness. And if we are immersed wholeheartedly, chances are we're going to do excellent work. But if I've learned if I set myself out to do excellent work, you know, I might do it, but there's a chance I won't come along myself.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be wholehearted and I won't be changed for the experience. So, you know, all to bring back to this conversation for this young poet is to be devoted to keep growing and not to stop casting seeds and trying to share again. And yeah, it hurts not to be heard and not to be seen, but it's more deadly not to see and hear.
Oh, that's beautiful, Mark. I just finished reading, because you were kind enough to send it to me in manuscript form, your beautiful new book, The One Life We Are Given.
Oh, thank you.
Which you know I loved, because I've told you already that I loved it. But if it's okay with you, I wanted to read to you your own writing, which I know is weird when people do that, but I've got it right here on my iPad.
Sure.
There's a line in this book, a paragraph that I wanted to read to you and then have you expound upon, because I think it's really important, because so much of what Cecilia is struggling with here is she had this very locked-in identity of herself as a poet, and then a bunch of professional people told her she wasn't good enough and she lost that identity, and now she's trying to create a new identity, and a lot of it is sort of identity-based suffering, identity-based questions, which I think are very appropriate for a young poet to be having those questions in her 20s.
Yes.
And certainly the same questions that you and I had at the same age, I'm assuming. But this is something I've never heard anybody say before, so I'm just going to read it to you and see if you can then respond to your own words from your new book. As a young man, I was driven to pour everything into my art. My identity was completely tied to what I would create, and more, to how my work would be received or not. It was an agonizing time, for my self-worth hinged on whether what I created was seen and valued by others. I worked so hard to be liked and wanted so badly to be loved, only to have each attempt pruned back by the insensitivities of a world that wouldn't slow down. Once I could drop down below the pain of my loneliness, I came to accept my solitude. And in that solitude, I found eternity and everyone else. I came back out into the world, offering my love and simply bearing witness to what is. It was only when I could give my love freely that I felt loved. Only when I let myself see the beauty in everyone without judgment, that others approached me with a smile and an open hand. So beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Can you add to that a bit? I mean, it's a bit perfect as it is in a way, but,
yeah.
But this idea of retreating from the world in order to come back with a gift for the world is something that I think is at the heart of a great deal of artistic endeavor.
Thank you for reading the manuscript and for you know, your kindness and in reading that passage. I feel that this is where it really wasn't retreating from the world, but diving in to what is foundational. Just like my father when he was building those little boats, when I give myself over completely, then I swim in the river of question. Then I swim in the river of anyone who's ever been hurt or rejected. And then in a feeling way, I'm not alone. And this to me is where resilience starts to show itself. When we feel what is ours to feel so thoroughly that we tap into the timeless river of everyone who's ever felt it. It's so, so hard to withstand rejection and the censure or the indifference, especially of people we respect.
Yeah.
And it carves us down to what is essential. So let me give two writer examples of both. You know, both are from the 1800s, the early American literature. And so the one negative example, poor Herman Melville.
Mm-hmm.
So Herman Melville, who in his early 30s, he had written several adventure sea novels, which came from his own experience at sea. And they were, you know, equivalent to bestsellers. Everybody loved them. And then in the depth of his soul, he was drawn to write Moby Dick. And Moby Dick now is considered one of the top five novels ever written by an American. And it was laughed at. It was seen with indifference and scorn. And Herman Melville took this so personally. He was 32 years old, just beginning to touch into his own genius, had just created a masterpiece, and he virtually stopped writing for 40 years.
And worked at the customs house, right?
Yeah.
Got a day job, which is, I'm always telling people to get day jobs, so that's not so bad. The problem is that he stopped writing.
And then it was only toward the end of it in his 70s that he wrote Billy Budd. And, oh, what a painful waste of, and I'm not blaming him. I feel for him, and I feel so that he didn't go through that in vain. You know, I hope, you know, our young poet will hear this story and say, you know, just keep seeing and hearing and celebrating life and finding your own voice. And, you know, the other side of that is Walt Whitman, who self-published Leaves of Grass his whole life.
Yeah.
And Tolstoy self-published War and Peace because everyone that he showed it to said, yeah, well, you know, it's a pretty interesting story, but it's depressing and it's too long.
Some of us still kind of think that. But I get your point. I get your point. You know, I love the letter that Whitman wrote to the newspapers talking about this great young poet, Whitman. He was such a good self-promoter. I've discovered the great new voice of America. He happened to be right, you know, but I love how he put himself out there that way.
another telling and very inspiring story about staying true to what you know to be true in yourself is that, you know, Emerson, who, as you know, discovered Whitman, and Whitman respected Emerson. And when Whitman was getting ready to publish his Children of Adam poems, which were revealing his homosexuality, that he was gay, and in his Specimen Days, in his diaries, he tells of this afternoon in the Boston Commons, for hours, Emerson just tried to persuade him not to make these poems public, not to publish them. And Whitman writes in his journal at the end of the day, said, I listened to good Emerson all day long, and I didn't say a word. And I knew at the end of the day more than ever in my heart that I was right.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And what a kind heart he had too, right? That he still called him good Emerson. You know, he knew that he was looking out for what he thought were Whitman's own best interests, but
yeah,
that only Walt could know that, you know, what his best interests were in this case.
And in fact, you know, I a great kind of, if our poet, young poet, is interested at all, or and I would recommend this, if not with Walt Whitman, with someone, a poet that she admires, you know, to read Song of Myself, and after each chapter to write in response to it.
Oh, what a good assignment. I'm going to do this. Song of Myself is my desert island book. You know, I wouldn't even mind being on a desert island if I had Song of Myself with me, because I figure I'd have a lot of time to memorize it. But I've never thought of responding to it. That's wonderful.
To be in conversation with what he opens to discover the song of
herself.
Herself. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. She's got a lot of assignments. I gave her a choice that she could either read the Iliad, the Odyssey, Gilgamesh, or the Vedas, because I said, you need to.
Oh, my God, they're all great.
They're all great. I was like, just pick one, because I want, similar to you, I want her to take the blinders off of this very limited modern mentality that says, I'm a poet if I have a profession and if I've been given a degree, and to recognize that she's being invited into a deep old sect of very special people. And she's part of that current. She's part of that river. And so I'll throw some Whitman at her too.
Yeah.
You can never go wrong with Uncle Walt, is the way I feel. Mark, I wonder, this is an odd request. I've not done this before, but I was wondering if I could leave this conversation by asking you to choose a word that's a blessing for Cecilia as she goes forward in her life that you can give to her. Whatever that stirs up in you, you respond how you like, but I feel like it would be nice coming from you.
Sure. And, you know, if it could, I also was thinking of this, that there's a short poem I would love to read for her.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So the word is wholehearted.
Nice.
The word is wholehearted. And to let that wholeheartedness be her teacher, all of our teacher. And the poem is mine, and it's called Breaking Surface. And it's really, you know, it's for young poets, but it's for all of us, myself included.
Please, we would love to hear it.
Let no one keep you from your journey. No rabbi or priest, no mother who wants you to dig for treasures she misplaced, no father who won't let one life be enough, no lover who measures their worth by what you might give up, no voice that tells you in the night it can't be done. Let nothing dissuade you from seeing what you see or feeling the winds that make you want to dance alone or go where no one has yet to go. You are the only explorer. Your heart, the unreadable compass. Your soul, the shore of a promise too great to be ignored.
Thank you, Mark. You're wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for giving us your words and your time and your wholeheartedness, not just today, but all days.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for including me as a part of this, too.
Hey, of course. lots of love. And again, we really appreciate it.
All right. You take care now. Thank you. Much love, too.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Mark Nepo is a poet, a teacher, a storyteller, and one of the most compassionate people I've ever met in my life. He's the author of several books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, The Book of Awakening. His newest book is called The One Life We're Given, Finding the Wisdom That Waits in Your Heart. I was lucky enough to read it in manuscript, and it's really beautiful. You can find out a lot more about him at marknepo.com. We're going to take a quick break now, but first, a word from our sponsor. So when I was in college, I had this plan for how to get the most interesting possible education that I could. And I used to go around to older students and ask them who gave the most exciting lectures. I didn't even care what the topic was. I just wanted to be in the room with the greatest teachers. And I had an incredible education because of that. And I've continued to try to do that in my life. I've never stopped trying to learn. And that's why I'm really into this thing called the Great Courses Plus, which is an on-demand video service that gives you access to some of the lectures given by some of the greatest scholars and academics and masters in the world. Everything from courses on engineering to drawing to physics to Tai Chi to the art of cooking. And one that I really liked recently that was just called the Creative Thinker's Toolkit. Don't have to explain to you why I would be into that. And the Great Courses Plus has offered a free month trial to my podcast listeners. What you do is you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. That is your magic word to be able to get into the Great Courses for free for a month and watch as many videos as you like and see if you enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, you can sign up for it and have it for the rest of your life. Remember, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. Okay, a few weeks have passed, and now it's time to check in on Cecilia and see how her poetry is going.
Hello.
Hi, is that Cecilia?
It is.
Hi, sweetheart. It's Liz Gilbert. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, too. This is your check-in.
It is.
It is. You sound nervous. Are you nervous?
Only a little bit. Only a little bit.
That's okay. You know, being nervous means you have skin in the game, and there's nothing wrong with having skin in the game. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talked about was trying to get you back into the groove of being a writer without worrying about the professional response to it. So what's it been like?
Well, I think there's a simple answer, which is that I guess it's not easy, which is not what I expected it to be. But I think I have made a really strong effort to make difficult decisions that I had to make to lead me to where I need to be. And one of the things you asked me to do was to read The Odyssey, not to skip ahead in this conversation, but I picked The Odyssey because it's the story of like a journey and change and not falling into, you know, a stagnant position. And I think reading The Odyssey has really helped me and kind of more than just legitimizing poetry as something like really old and worthy, but also in kind of moving me forwards also.
Wow. Okay, first of all, thank you, Homer. There's a reason we're still telling that story. There's a reason we're still telling that story thousands of years later, and there's a reason we're going to keep telling it till the world explodes. And it seems like you've tapped into that reason, and I'm wondering, first of all, thank you for doing that. That was a big homework assignment. I mean, you know, sending somebody back to read The Odyssey is not a joke, right? It's not like, you know, rent a video. It's an intense experience. But I wonder if you can give me some more specifics about difficult decisions that you've had to make and changes that have been happening in your own Odyssey.
Yeah, well, I have been living out of the state that I grew up in. So I've been living in Florida. And I grew up in Texas, and over the last couple of weeks, just based on a lot of changes that have happened, my husband and I have made the decision to move back to Texas. And it wasn't easy because I think I saw myself as someone who wanted to be away, and not away from my family, but just someone who wanted to move and have this, you know, big adventure. But I realized that if I wanted to put poetry and art and all these things as priorities in my life, I needed more of a backbone and, you know, support structure. And so we kind of both made that decision because he does a creative thing as well. And so we are moving back to have that support structure so that we can have day jobs but also have time to focus on our art as well.
Does that feel good?
It does.
Yeah? Okay, because you sound a little shaky about it. So I wanted to make sure, like, that feels like the move that will nourish you the most. Is that how it feels?
It feels like the best thing for us. It also just feels very overwhelming.
Yeah. And have you found time to be working on any writing in the meantime? Or between reading The Odyssey and moving states, have you had a lot of opportunity?
Yes. I have been writing a lot and kind of allowing myself to just write whatever I felt like and not putting as much pressure or structure on what I'm writing, which is really kind of wonderful.
Really? Can you tell me about what that's been like and what you're working on?
Yeah, I previously felt like what I was missing maybe was structure after I didn't get into the MFA programs, and because that's kind of what I thought I was missing out on, I tried to force myself into that in some ways by, I don't know, maybe over-planning what I was working on or trying to stick to exact deadlines. And instead, I've just kind of let myself write, and I still try to write every single day, but it's not as pressurized to hit a certain deadline or to have a certain amount done by a certain time. And it's been really nice.
Oh, so good. Yeah, I mean, the thing about, it's such a balance. I mean, you know, as I always say, we're all adults here, so we can handle paradox. And one of the paradoxes mm-hmm. of creative living is this balance between the need for structure and the need for freedom. And You know, there's the psychiatrists always say that, that most people either need to be loosened up or screwed down. you know, it's one or the other. But actually, I feel like in my own life, I kind of need both. Like there are parts of me that need to be loosened up and there are parts of me that need to be screwed down. And especially in creative adventures, there are seasons where what I really need is that discipline of getting up every morning and working for an hour a day religiously. And then there are seasons where I really need to break away from that because it's becoming too much like punching a clock at a factory. Mm-hmm. And the responsibility of the artist is to be honest every single day and every single season about what you need. And it sounds like what you've been needing is less structure in a way and more freedom to remember the kind of joy of creation. Does that sound right?
I think it does. In your conversation with Mark Nepo, mm-hmm. he said something about trying to be a verb and not a noun.
Yeah.
And that has really stuck with me. And I'm making a concerted effort every day to not try to be a thing, but to try to do a thing.
Yes.
and I love it.
So instead of the goal being to be a poet, mm-hmm. the action is to make poetry.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and the really handy thing about that is that accidentally you do then become the noun. mm-hmm. because what is a poet except somebody who makes poetry every day, right?
Exactly.
Tell me about how you felt about that conversation with Mark. How did that feel, hearing him speaking about his own creative process and also about yours?
It was wonderful, first of all. I think I listened to it like 10 times. And I also printed the poem he read at the end of it. I printed it out and I read it every day. I think something I've really missed since being in school studying poetry was having someone to talk to about it.
Yeah.
And I've found people in my life who love art or that I can talk to about books, but poetry specifically has been harder for me to find someone who understands it or feels as connected to it as I do.
Yeah.
And so not only was it, you know, kind of a weird reality to hear him talking about me, but even more so just to hear him talking about poetry and the way I feel about poetry was really great. And it actually leads me to a question I have for you.
Oh, good. Let's turn the tables.
About.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think one of the things I'm still really jealous of people in these MFA programs is that they kind of have a built-in community.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if you had any advice on how outside of that to find or build a community that focuses on, you know, art or self-expression, or specifically poetry for me without having that structure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, jealousy is a great teacher. It's an emotion that we all try to tamp down because it doesn't feel good mm-hmm. and it can be embarrassing and you're not supposed to have it. But one of the things I've learned whenever I experience jealousy is that jealousy is there to show you what you are longing for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly that's happened with you when you feel jealous of the community that those people have. I can give you a fuller perspective on it by saying another thing that they have is intense competition.
right.
Sometimes
yeah, definitely.
Sometimes backbiting, sometimes undermining. Like sometimes it's not as wholly a conversation as you might wish. But yes, indeed. I mean, that's what academia at its best provides is mm-hmm. and should provide is this beautiful, fertile ground for people to come together and have the time and the space to talk about ideas and to talk about creation. I've spoken in past episodes of Magic Lessons about how I created that in my own life because I didn't, as I told you, I didn't go to an MFA. And I went searching for other people who had the same longing. And it was not difficult to find them. You know, I just focused on it. I just focused on it and I asked around and I found people who I knew wanted to be writers the same way that I did. And then I made the structure and I said, we're meeting at my house every other Tuesday from now until the end of time. And we will set aside a couple hours a day and this is what we'll talk about. You know, oftentimes I think what happens is that the great institutions disappoint us because we go there expecting a communion that we do not find, right? And this is why people sometimes get depressed when they do get to those programs. This is why sometimes people who are looking for spiritual nourishment get depressed when they go to church, because this structure and this edifice that is supposed to be feeding you in this most intimate way actually ends up sort of just being an institution that feeds itself, you know, and you don't get that. And so if you don't have the great professors at your fingertips, then go out into your community and find people who have the same longing that you have and bring them to you. If you don't have that, you make it. And that's kind of one of the ultimate creative acts that you can possibly do. Now, you can either do that literally within your own community, wherever it is that you're moving. In Texas, it is not difficult to find people who wish to create. It really isn't. They are everywhere, and they are silent, and sometimes they're ashamed, and sometimes they're afraid, and sometimes they think they're too old, and sometimes they think they're too late, and sometimes they think they're not smart enough, but they are out there. And if you can provide a beacon light to bring them to you, then you can be the person instigating those conversations. And we did reading assignments. I mean, we did everything that people do in school. You know, we would say, everybody's reading this poem, and next week we're talking about this. You know, everybody's going to read this short story, and next week we're talking about this. That's something that you can make.
Yeah.
And it's something that it feels to me like you must make. Because you have every right to long for that. And that longing and that jealousy that you felt, and also that connection that you felt to Mark Nepo when you heard him speaking about something that matters to you, is just a signal that you don't want to be alone in this. And as our friend Brené Brown taught us, you know, creativity is not something that has to be done alone, and it was never meant to be done alone. So the other great thing is this thing called the internet, which has total world access to virtually every human on earth. There are places where you can go and you can put your call out into the universe in a very literal way and say, I am seeking community on this subject. Is anybody with me? Does anybody want to talk about this? They are out there. It requires doing some homework, but you're good at that. You know, you wouldn't have wanted to go to school and loved school so much if you weren't good at that.
Right.
So it really is a question of pulling them to you, becoming a summoner. And I know that you have the power of being a summoner, because you summoned me and Mark Nepo to your side, right? Like, so you can't front to me that you don't have power, because look what you just did, and look what you just made. And pay attention to your jealousy. You know, I experienced it. I had a wave of jealousy reading Donna Tartt's latest book, The Goldfinch, that came out a couple of years ago. And I was like, I want to write like that. You know, I want to write like that. And instead of being embarrassed by that longing, I felt like it was a message. And the message was, you're not done learning how to be a better writer yet. You know,
yeah.
I want to write that book. It's going to take me doubling down and just trying to experience mastery even more. That's a really good feeling to have, because it means that you still care. You know, when in that conversation with Mark, the thing that I was really struck by is when he said, we live in a society where everybody's trying to get attention, but what we're not focusing on is what we're giving attention to. And I wondered if that had struck you, and how you felt about that in your own life.
That kind of fits into his verb and noun thing for me, in that I wasn't focusing on poetry, maybe, in a way. I mean, I was still writing, I was still reading it, but I was only writing or reading it to be a poet, not to focus on the poetry.
Oh, right. You were preparing for your life as a poet.
Right, exactly. And taking that step away from being a poet and focusing on poetry definitely has been really important.
You know, well, I'm going to not get it right, but there's a Whitman line that's about your whole body becoming a poem. You know, it's so much more interesting for me to see people allow their lives to become a work of art than for them to be aggressively making works of art and trying to sell them and trying to get attention and acclaim for it. Let your life itself be the work of art. It means giving attention to what's beautiful to you. It means summoning people to you who care and long for the same things. It means having the courage to make big changes, and moving from what you expected into the new and the dangerous and the unknown. I mean, all of that turns you, Cecilia, into the poem.
There's a poet Muriel Rukeyser, and she has a quote that says, breathe in experience, breathe out poetry. And I think that fits what you're trying to say as well, this idea of living poetry.
See, that's the thing that pisses me off about you poets, is that you guys just say it better and faster. I just gave a paragraph on that, and then she just whoops out like 6 words. It's the efficiency of poetry that I envy. You know, it, like I can spin and spin and spin, and it'll take me a while to get to that same place. But I love the poets for that. You know, that is exactly it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the other assignments that I gave you was to ask you to create a diploma. I was wondering if you did that and if you can describe it to us.
I did do that. And in a strange way, this is the hardest part for me of what you asked me to do. I spent so much time like agonizing about how I was going to create it and what it would look like and how I could make it perfect. And eventually I just kind of forced myself to not care about that and to just make it and hang it up above my desk and not expect it to be anything more than just something that's important to me. So I tore a piece of paper out of my journal and I made a certificate.
What does it say?
It says, Certificate of Poetry awarded to Cecilia Chard, a poet and a romantic. And then it has that quote from Muriel Rukeyser on the bottom.
I love that so much. I love that so much. Here's who gets to take that away from you. Nobody ever, nobody ever gets to take that away from you. That is yours. And it's so touching to me that that was the hardest thing. Like in the end, it's so simple. I mean, those words, I mean, say it again. It's the simplest thing in the world. Just read it one more time.
Certificate of Poetry awarded to Cecilia, a poet and a romantic. Breathe in experience, breathe out poetry.
How many weeks did it take you to say that?
Oh, too long.
Isn't that crazy? Like, it's such a simple sentiment, and yet you struggled and struggled and struggled because you were struggling with the permission of whether you're entitled to have that diploma. And I hope that you believe now that you do.
I mean, I think it's always a journey, but I'm definitely in the right direction.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned romanticism because there's something tremendously romantic about making art and somebody who has that spirit and who just wants to make beauty and then putting it out in the marketplace and having the gatekeepers refuse it. The danger is what will happen to you, which is that you stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to, just remind me, what happens to Cecilia when she stops writing poetry?
Not good things. I kind of fell apart.
Yeah. This is why you have to have your diploma with you all the time.
Mm-hmm, I know.
And this is why you have to work on your magical sorcery summoning powers to summon the community around you who will respect and love the same things that you do. This is why you have to honor your jealousy when it gives you a pang of longing to listen to it, because mm-hmm. that's education. You know, that's you being educated about what you want and what you want to be in the world. I think I specifically asked you when you were reading one of those classical works that I offered you to see if you could find one line that felt like it resonated with you. I wonder if you found mm-hmm. one line from the Odyssey that you feel like is really yours.
I found a bunch, but I narrowed it down to one to share with you.
Okay.
The line I picked was from the Odyssey, and it is, "The creation of genius always seems like a miracle."
Oh, because it always is.
Yes, I know.
Oh, my God. It's so deeply reassuring to me to see that that question was on the table so many thousands of years ago and it remains on the table today. And I think that could be a really good motto for the whole Magic Lessons podcast, by the way.
Wow. I'm taking it as a motto for my life. So.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I'm so glad you had that experience with the Odyssey. And I'm glad that you're moving. Look, I know it's scary, but you're talking to somebody who I literally move every 2 years at the most. I find it really difficult to create in the same place for very long. And I know there are people who, my friend Ann Patchett always says that I'm a hunter and she's a gatherer. She's somebody who longs for stability. But there, I got to tell you, man, good things happen when you move. You get rid of a lot of junk that you didn't need anymore and you come into a fresh space and extraordinary things occur. I am all for it. If I could, I would make everyone move all the time. So I know it's a big deal for you to be making this shift in your life, but I can't help but think that this is part of what is exactly necessary for you right now. And I'm also glad that you're not trying to get your work published right now. I've given you forbidden you from putting it into the marketplace until you believe your diploma completely. And until you've found your own community and until you're doing work for other reasons. So thank you for coming on and being so vulnerable with us and telling us everything that's happened. I appreciate it so much. I'm so glad you're working again. That makes me really, really pleased.
Thank you. This has meant a lot to me.
So keep being a verb.
I will.
And let us know how it continues. I'm curious to see what you're going to become next. As you keep verbing your way through the world. Thank you, and be well, okay?
Thank you, too.
Bye.
Bye.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you'll join us next time. Magic Lessons is a production of the Maximum Fun Network. Michelle Siegel is our extraordinary producer. Our theme music is by Dave Cahill, and it was performed by Dave Cahill and Dallas Vietti. Special thanks to Paul Ruest of Argo Studios and Jesse Thorne of Maximum Fun. You can hear all the episodes and find out a lot more about my comings and goings at elizabethgilbert.com. And of course, if you want to continue your own explorations into creativity, which I really hope you will do, it might help you to pick up my book, which is called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, published by Riverhead Books. If you can, please leave us a comment on iTunes. It helps other people discover the show, and we appreciate it. And let's keep this conversation going on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Gilbert Liz. See you next time.
I'm Hal Lublin.
I'm Danielle Radford.
I am Michael Eagle.
And we are the hosts of Tights and Fights, Maximum Fun's newest podcast dedicated to all things wrestling.
We'll be talking about Sasha Banks, the women's revolution, Sasha Banks, the brand split, and Sasha Banks' wigs.
And we'll also be talking about wrestler fashion. Some wrestlers wear too many clothes. Some wrestlers don't wear enough clothes at all.
And I'll be doing impressions of all your favorite wrestlers.
New episodes Thursdays on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, yeah, dig it.
Tights and Fights Podcast. Tights and Fights.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.